Right. What are the rules of this game, and how might we best play it?
The nature of the labyrinth, I scribbled into my spiral notebook, and the way out of it. This teacher rocked. I hated discussion classes. I hated talking, and I hated listening to everyone else stumble on their words and try to phrase things in the vaguest possible ways so they wouldn't sound dumb. And I hated how it was all just a game of trying to figure out what the teacher wanted to hear and then saying it. I'm in class, so teach me. And teach me he did. In those 50 minutes, the old man made me take religion seriously. I'd never been religious, but he told us that religion is important whether or not we believed in one, in the same way that historical events are important whether or not you personally lived through them. And then he assigned us 50 pages of reading for the next day from a book called Religious Studies. That afternoon, I had 2 classes and 2 free periods. We had 9 50-minute class periods each day, which means that most everyone had 3 study periods, except for the colonel, who had an extra independent study math class on account of being an extra special genius. The colonel and I had biology together, where I pointed out the other guy who'd duct-taped me the night before. In the top corner of his notebook, the colonel wrote, "Longwell Chase, Senior W. Day Warrior, friends with Sarah. Weird." It took me a minute to remember who Sarah was, the colonel's girlfriend. I spent my free periods in my room trying to read about religion. I learned that myth doesn't mean a lie. It means a traditional story that tells you something about people and their worldview and what they hold sacred. Interesting. I also learned that after the events of the previous night, I was far too tired to care about myths or anything else, so I slept on top of the covers for most of the afternoon until I awoke to Alaska singing, "Wake up, little Pudgy," directly into my left ear canal. I held the religion book close up against my chest like a small paperback security blanket. "That was terrible," I said. "What do I need to do to ensure that never happens to me again?" "Nothing you can do," she said excitedly. "I'm unpredictable. God, don't you hate Dr. Hyde, don't you? He's so condescending." I sat up and said, "I think he's a genius," partly because I thought it was true and partly because I just felt like disagreeing with her. She sat down on the bed. "Do you always sleep in your clothes?" "Yep." "Funny," she said. "You weren't wearing much last night." I just glared at her. "Come on, Pudge, I'm teasing. You have to be tough here. I didn't know how bad it was, and I'm sorry, and they'll regret it, but you have to be tough." And then she left. That was all she had to say on the subject. "She's cute," I thought, "but you don't need to like a girl who treats you like you're 10. You've already got a mom." 122 days before. After my last class of my first week at Culver Creek, I entered room 43 to an unlikely sight. The diminutive and shirtless colonel hunched over an ironing board, attacking a pink button-down shirt. Sweat trickled down his forehead and chest as he ironed with great enthusiasm, his right arm pushing the iron across the length of the shirt with such vigor that his breathing nearly duplicated Dr. Hyde's. "I have a date," he explained. "This is an emergency." He paused to catch his breath. "Do you know how to iron?" I walked over to the pink shirt. It was wrinkled, like an old woman who'd spent her youth sunbathing. If only the colonel didn't ball up his every belonging and stuff it into random dresser drawers. "I think you just turn it on and press it against the shirt, right?" I said. "I don't know. I didn't even know we had an iron." "We don't. It's Takumi's. But Takumi doesn't know how to iron either. And when I asked Alaska, she started yelling, 'You're not going to impose the patriarchal paradigm on me.' Oh, God, I need to smoke. I need to smoke, but I can't reek when I see Sarah's parents. Okay, screw it. We're going to smoke in the bathroom with the shower on. The shower has steam. Steam gets rid of wrinkles, right?" "By the way," he said as I followed him into the bathroom, "if you want to smoke inside during the day, just turn on the shower. The smoke follows the steam up the vents." Though this made no scientific sense, it seemed to work. The shower's shortage of water pressure and low shower head made it all but useless for showering, but it worked great as a smokescreen. Sadly, it made a poor iron. The colonel tried ironing the shirt once more.
"I'm just going to push really hard and see if that helps."
and finally put it on wrinkled. He matched the shirt with a blue tie decorated with horizontal lines of little pink flamingos.
"The one thing my lousy father taught me," the colonel said as his hands nimbly threaded the tie into a perfect knot, "was how to tie a tie. Which is odd, since I can't imagine when he ever had to wear one."
Just then, Sarah knocked on the door. I'd seen her once or twice before, but the colonel never introduced me to her, and didn't have a chance to that night.
"Oh, my God, can't you at least press your shirt?" she asked, even though the colonel was standing in front of the ironing board. "We're going out with my parents."
Sarah looked awfully nice in her blue summer dress. Her long, pale blonde hair was pulled up into a twist, with a strand of hair falling down each side of her face. She looked like a movie star. A bitchy one.
"Look, I did my best. We don't all have maids to do our ironing."
"Chip, that chip on your shoulder makes you look even shorter."
"Christ, can't we get out the door without fighting?"
"I'm just saying, it's the opera. It's a big deal to my parents. Whatever, let's go."
I felt like leaving, but it seemed stupid to hide in the bathroom, and Sarah was standing in the doorway, one hand cocked on her hip and the other fiddling with her car keys as if to say, "Let's go."
"I could wear a tuxedo and your parents would still hate me," he shouted.
"That's not my fault. You antagonize them."
She held up the car keys in front of him.
"Look, we're going now or we're not going."
"Fuck it. I'm not going anywhere with you," the colonel said.
"Fine. Have a great night."
Sarah slammed the door so hard that a sizable biography of Leo Tolstoy, last words, "The truth is, I care a great deal, what they," fell off my bookshelf and landed with a thud on our checkered floor like an echo of the slamming door.
"Ah!"
he screamed. "So, that's Sarah," I said.
"Yes."
"She seems nice."
The colonel laughed, knelt down next to the mini-fridge, and pulled out a gallon of milk. He opened it, took a swig, winced, half-coughed, and sat down on the couch with the milk between his legs.
"Is it sour or something?"
"Oh, I should have mentioned that earlier. This isn't milk. It's 5 parts milk and 1 part vodka. I call it ambrosia, drink of the gods. You can barely smell the vodka in the milk, so the eagle can't catch me unless he actually takes a sip. The downside is that it tastes like sour milk and rubbing alcohol, but it's Friday night, Pudge, and my girlfriend is a bitch. Want some?"
"I think I'll pass."
Aside from a few sips of champagne on New Year's, under the watchful eye of my parents, I'd never really drunk any alcohol, and ambrosia didn't seem like the drink with which to start. Outside, I heard the payphone ring. Given the fact that 190 boarders shared 5 payphones, I was amazed at how infrequently it rang. We weren't supposed to have cell phones, but I'd noticed that some of the weekday warriors carried them surreptitiously. And most non-warriors called their parents, as I did, on a regular basis, so parents only called when their kids forgot.
"Are you going to get that?" the colonel asked me.
I didn't feel like being bossed around by him, but I also didn't feel like fighting. Through a buggy twilight, I walked to the payphone, which was drilled into the wall between rooms 44 and 45. On both sides of the phone, dozens of phone numbers and esoteric notes were written in pen and marker. 205-555-1584. Tommy to Airport 420. 773-573-6521. JG, cuffs? Calling the payphone required a great deal of patience. I picked up on about the 9th ring.
"Can you get Chip for me?" Sarah asked.
It sounded like she was on a cell phone.
"Yeah, hold on."
I turned, and he was already behind me, as if he knew it would be her. I handed him the receiver and walked back to the room. A minute later, 3 words made their way to our room through the thick, still air of Alabama at almost night.
"Screw you too," the colonel shouted.
Back in the room, he sat down with his ambrosia and told me,
"She says I ratted out Paul and Mariah. That's what the warriors are saying, that I ratted them out, me. That's why the piss in the shoes. That's why the nearly killing you, 'cause you live with me and they say I'm a rat."
I tried to remember who Paul and Mariah were. The names were familiar, but I'd heard so many names in the last week, and I couldn't match Paul and Mariah with faces. And then I remembered why. I'd never seen them. They got kicked out the year before, having committed the trifecta. "How long have you been dating her?" I asked.
9 months. We never got along. I mean, I didn't even briefly like her. Like my mom and my dad. My dad would get pissed, and then he would beat the shit out of my mom. And then my dad would be all nice, and they'd have like a honeymoon period. But with Sarah, there's never a honeymoon period.
God, how could she think I was a rat?
I know. Why don't we break up?
He ran a hand through his hair, clutching a fistful of it atop his head, and said,
I guess I stay with her because she stays with me. And that's not an easy thing to do. I'm a bad boyfriend. She's a bad girlfriend. We deserve each other.
But
I can't believe they think that, he said as he walked to the bookshelf and pulled down the almanac.
He took a long pull off his ambrosia.
Goddamn weekday warriors. It was probably one of them that ratted out Paul and Mariah and then blamed me to cover their tracks. Anyway, it's a good night for staying in. Staying in with Pudge and Ambrosia.
I said, wanting to say that I didn't understand how you could kiss someone who believed you were a rat if being a rat was the worst thing in the world, but the colonel cut me off.
Not another word about it. You know what the capital of Sierra Leone is?
No.
Me neither, he said, but I intend to find out.
And with that, he stuck his nose in the almanac, and the conversation was over. 110 days before. Keeping up with my classes proved easier than I'd expected. My general predisposition to spending a lot of time inside reading gave me a distinct advantage over the average Culver Creek student. By the third week of classes, plenty of kids had been sunburned to a Bufrito-like golden brown from days spent chatting outside in the shadeless dorm circle during free periods. But I was barely pink. I studied. And I listened in class, too. But on that Wednesday morning, when Dr. Hyde started talking about how Buddhists believe that all things are interconnected, I found myself staring out the window. I was looking at the wooded, slow-sloping hill beyond the lake, and from Hyde's classroom, things did seem connected. The trees seemed to clothe the hill, and just as I would never think to notice a particular cotton thread in the magnificently tight orange tank top Alaska wore that day, I couldn't see the trees for the forest. Everything so intricately woven together that it made no sense to think of one tree as independent from that hill. And then I heard my name. And I knew I was in trouble.
Mr. Halter, the old man said, here I am straining my lungs for your edification, and yet something out there seems to have caught your fancy in a way that I've been unable to do. Pray tell, what have you discovered out there?
Now I felt my own breath shorten, the whole class watching me, thanking God they weren't me. Dr. Hyde had already done this 3 times, kicking kids out of class for not paying attention or writing notes to one another. I was just looking outside at the hill and thinking about, the trees and the forest, like you were saying earlier, about the way... The old man, who obviously did not tolerate vocalized rambling, cut me off.
I'm going to ask you to leave class, Mr. Halter, so that you can go out there and discover the relationship between the trees and the forest. And tomorrow, when you're ready to take this class seriously, I will welcome you back.
I sat still, my pen resting in my hand, my notebook open, my face flushed, and my jaw jutting out into an underbite, an old trick I had to keep from looking sad or scared. 2 rows behind me, I heard a chair move and turned around to see Alaska standing up, slinging her backpack over one arm.
I'm sorry, but that's bullshit. You can't just throw him out of class. You drone on and on for an hour every day and we're not allowed to glance out the window?
The old man stared back at Alaska like a bull at a matador, then raised a hand to his sagging face and slowly rubbed the white stubble on his cheek.
For 50 minutes a day, 5 days a week, you abide by my rules, or you fail. The choice is yours. Both of you leave.
I stuffed my notebook into my backpack and walked out, humiliated. As the door shut behind me, I felt a tap on my left shoulder. I turned, but there was no one there. Then I turned the other way, and Alaska was smiling at me. The skin between her eyes and temple crinkled into a starburst.
"The oldest trick in the book," she said, "but everybody falls for it."
I tried a smile, but I couldn't stop thinking about Dr. Hyde. It was worse than the duct tape incident, because I always knew that the Kevin Richmonds of the world didn't like me, but my teachers had always been card-carrying members of the Miles Halter fan club.
"I told you he was an asshole," she said.
"I still think he's a genius. He's right. I wasn't listening."
"Right, but he didn't need to be a jerk about it. Like he needs to prove his power by humiliating you."
"Anyway," she said, "the only real geniuses are artists. Yeats, Picasso, Garcia Marquez, geniuses. Dr. Hyde, bitter old man." And then she announced that we were going to look for four-leaf clovers until class ended, and we could go smoke with the Colonel and Takumi.
"Both of whom," she added, "are big-time assholes for not marching out of class right behind us."
When Alaska Young is sitting with her legs crossed in a brittle, periodically green clover patch, leaning forward in search of four-leaf clovers, the pale skin of her sizable cleavage clearly visible, it is a plain fact of human physiology that it becomes impossible to join in her clover search. I'd gotten in enough trouble already for looking where I wasn't supposed to, but still. After perhaps 2 minutes of combing through a clover patch with her long, dirty fingernails, Alaska grabbed a clover with three full-size petals and an undersized runt of a fourth, then looked up at me, barely giving me time to avert my eyes.
"Even though you were clearly not doing your part in the clover search, perv," she said wryly, "I really would give you this clover, except luck is for suckers."
She pinched the runt petal between the nails of her thumb and finger and plucked it.
"There," she said to the clover as she dropped it on the ground. "Now you're not a genetic freak anymore."
Thanks, I said. The bell rang, and Takumi and the Colonel were first out the door. Alaska stared at them.
"What?" asked the Colonel, but she just rolled her eyes and started walking.
We followed in silence through the dorm circle and then across the soccer field. We ducked into the woods, following the faint path around the lake until we came to a dirt road. The Colonel ran up to Alaska, and they started fighting about something quietly enough that I couldn't hear the words so much as the mutual annoyance, and I finally asked Takumi where we were headed.
"This road dead ends into the barn," he said, "so maybe there, but probably the smoking hole. You'll see."
From here, the woods were a totally different creature than from Dr. Hyde's classroom. The ground was thick with fallen branches, decaying pine needles, and brambly green bushes. The path wound past pine trees, sprouting tall and thin, their stubbly needles providing a lace of shade from another sunburned day. And the smaller oak and maple trees, which from Dr. Hyde's classroom had been invisible beneath the more majestic pines, showed hints of an as yet thermally unforeseeable fall. Their still green leaves were beginning to droop. We came to a rickety wooden bridge, just thick plywood laid over a concrete foundation, over Culver Creek, the winding rivulet that doubled back over and over again through the outskirts of campus. On the far side of the bridge, there was a tiny path leading down a steep slope. Not even a path so much as a series of hints, a broken branch here, a patch of stump down grass there, that people had come this way before. As we walked down single file, Alaska, the Colonel, and Takumi each held back a thick maple branch for one another, passing it along until I, last in line, let it snap back into place behind me. And there, beneath the bridge, an oasis. A slab of concrete 3 feet wide and 10 feet long, with blue plastic chairs stolen long ago from some classroom. Cooled by the creek and the shade of the bridge, I felt unhot for the first time in weeks. The Colonel dispensed the cigarettes. Takumi passed, the rest of us lit up.
"He has no right to condescend to us, is all I'm saying," Alaska said, continuing her conversation with the Colonel. Pudge is done with staring out the window, and I'm done with going on tirades about it, but he's a terrible teacher, and you won't convince me otherwise.
Fine, the colonel said. Just don't make another scene. Christ, you nearly killed the poor old bastard.
Seriously, you'll never win by crossing Hyde, Takumi said. He'll eat you alive, shit you out, and then piss on his dump. Which, by the way, is what we should be doing to whoever ratted on Mariah. Has anyone heard anything?
It must have been some weekday warrior, Alaska said, but apparently they think it was the colonel, so who knows? Maybe the eagle just got lucky. She was stupid. She got caught. She got expelled. It's over. That's what happens when you're stupid and you get caught.
Alaska made an O with her lips, moving her mouth like a goldfish, eating, trying unsuccessfully to blow smoke rings.
Wow, Takumi said. If I ever get kicked out, remind me to even the score myself, since I sure can't count on you.
Don't be ridiculous, she responded, not angry so much as dismissive. I don't understand why you're so obsessed with figuring out everything that happens here, like we have to unravel every mystery. God, it's over. Takumi, you gotta stop stealing other people's problems and get some of your own.
Takumi started up again, but Alaska raised her hand as if to swap the conversation away. I said nothing. I hadn't known Mariah, and anyway, listening quietly was my general social strategy.
Anyway, Alaska said to me, I thought the way he treated you was just awful. I wanted to cry. I just wanted to kiss you and make it better.
Shame you didn't, I deadpanned, and they laughed.
You're adorable, she said, and I felt the intensity of her eyes on me and looked away nervously. Too bad I love my boyfriend.
I stared at the knotted roots of the trees on the creek bank, trying hard not to look like I'd just been called adorable. Takumi couldn't believe it either, and he walked over to me, tussling my hair with his hand, and started rapping to Alaska.
Yeah, Pudge is adorable, but you want incorrigible, so Jake is more endurable because he's so damn, I almost had four rhymes on adorable. But all I could think of was unflorable, which isn't even a word.
Alaska laughed. That made me not be mad at you anymore. God, rapping is sexy. Pudge, did you even know that you're in the presence of the sickest MC in Alabama?
No.
Drop a beat, Colonel Catastrophe, Takumi said, and I laughed at the idea that a guy as short and dorky as the Colonel could have a rap name.
The Colonel cupped his hands around his mouth and started making some absurd noises that I supposed were intended to be beats.
P-chee, p-poo-p-chee.
Takumi laughed.
Right here by the river, you want me to kick it. If your smoke was a popsicle, I'd surely lick it. My rhyming is old school, sorta like the ancient Romans. The Colonel's beat is sad like Arthur Miller's Willie Loman. Sometimes I'm accused of being a showman. I can rhyme fast, and I can rhyme slow, man.
He paused, took a breath, and then finished.
Like Emily Dickinson, I ain't afraid of slant rhyme. And that's the end of this verse. MC's out on a high.
I didn't know slant rhyme from regular rhyme, but I was suitably impressed. We gave Takumi a soft round of applause. Alaska finished her cigarette and flicked it into the river.
Why do you smoke so damn fast? I asked.
She looked at me and smiled widely, and such a wide smile on her narrow face might have looked goofy were it not for the unimpeachably elegant green in her eyes. She smiled at me with all the delight of a kid on Christmas morning and said,
Y'all smoke to enjoy it. I smoke to die.
109 days before. Dinner in the cafeteria the next night was meatloaf, one of the rare dishes that didn't arrive deep-fried, and perhaps as a result, meatloaf was Maureen's greatest failure, a stringy, gravy-soaked concoction that did not much resemble a loaf and did not much taste like meat. Although I'd never ridden in it, Alaska apparently had a car, and she offered to drive the colonel and me to McDonald's, but the colonel didn't have any money, and I didn't have much either, what with constantly paying for his extravagant cigarette habit. So instead, the colonel and I reheated two-day-old burritos. Unlike, say, French fries, a microwaved burrito lost nothing of its taste or its satisfying crunch, after which the colonel insisted on attending the Creek's first basketball game of the season.
Basketball? In the fall? I asked the colonel. I don't know much about sports, but isn't that when you play football?
The schools in our league are too small to have football teams, so we play basketball in the fall. Although, man, the Culver Creek football team would be a thing of beauty. Your scrawny ass could probably start at lineman. Anyway, the basketball games are great.
I hated sports. I hated sports, and I hated people who played them, and I hated people who watched them, and I hated people who didn't hate people who watched or played them. In third grade, the very last year that one could play t-ball, my mother wanted me to make friends, so she forced me onto the Orlando Pirates. I made friends, all right, with a bunch of kindergartners, which didn't really bolster my social standing with my peers. Primarily because I towered over the rest of the players, I nearly made it onto the T-ball All-Star team that year. The kid who beat me, Clay Wurzel, had one arm. I was an unusually tall third grader with two arms, and I got beat out by kindergartner Clay Wurzel. And it wasn't some pity-the-one-armed kid thing, either. Clay Wurzel could flat-out hit, whereas I sometimes struck out even with the ball sitting on the tee. One of the things that appealed to me most about Culver Creek was that my dad assured me there was no P.E. requirement.
There is only one time when I put aside my passionate hatred for the weekday warriors and their country club bullshit, the colonel told me, and that's when they pump up the air conditioning in the gym for a little old-fashioned Culver Creek basketball. You can't miss the first game of the year.
As we walked toward the airplane hangar of a gym, which I had seen but never even thought to approach, the colonel explained to me the most important thing about our basketball team. They were not very good. The star of the team, the colonel said, was a senior named Hank Walston, who played power forward despite being 5'8". Hank's primary claim to campus fame, I already knew, was that he always had weed, and the colonel told me that for 4 years, Hank started every game without ever once playing sober.
He loves weed like Alaska loves sex, the colonel said. This is a man who once constructed a bong using only the barrel of an air rifle, a ripe pear, and an 8x10 glossy photograph of Anna Kournikova. Not the brightest gem in the jewelry shop, but you've got to admire his single-minded dedication to drug abuse.
From Hank, the colonel told me, it went downhill until you reached Wilson Carbod, the starting center, who was almost 6 feet tall.
We're so bad, the colonel said, we don't even have a mascot. I call us the Culver Creek Nothings.
So they just suck? I asked. I didn't quite understand the point of watching your terrible team get walloped, though the air conditioning was reason enough for me.
Oh, they suck, the colonel replied, but we always beat the shit out of the deaf and blind school.
Apparently, basketball wasn't a big priority at the Alabama School for the Deaf and Blind, and so we usually came out of the season with a single victory. When we arrived, the gym was packed with most every Culver Creek student. I noticed, for instance, the Creek's three goth girls reapplying their eyeliner as they sat in the top row of the gym's bleachers. I'd never attended a school basketball game back home, but I doubted the crowds there were quite so inclusive. Even so, I was surprised when none other than Kevin Richmond sat down on the bleacher directly in front of me, while the opposing school's cheerleading team, their unfortunate school colors were mud brown and dehydrated piss yellow, tried to fire up the small visitors section in the crowd. Kevin turned around and stared at the colonel. Like most of the other guy warriors, Kevin dressed preppy, looking like a lawyer who enjoys golfing waiting to happen. And his hair, a blonde mop, short on the sides and spiky on top, was always soaked through with so much gel that it looked perennially wet. I didn't hate him like the colonel did, of course, because the colonel hated him on principle, and principled hate is a hell of a lot stronger than, boy, I wish you hadn't mummified me and thrown me into the lake hate. Still, I tried to stare at him intimidatingly as he looked at the colonel, but it was hard to forget that this guy had seen my skinny ass in nothing but boxers a couple weeks ago.
You ratted out Paul and Mariah. We got you back. Truce? Kevin asked. I didn't rat them out. Pudge here certainly didn't rat them out, but you brought him in on your fun.
Truce? Let me take a poll real quick. The cheerleaders sat down, holding their pom-poms close to their chest as if praying.
Hey, Pudge, the colonel said, what do you think of a truce?
It reminds me of when the Germans demanded that the U.S. surrender at the Battle of the Bulge, I said. I guess I'd say to this truce offer what General McAuliffe said to that one. Nuts.
Why would you try to kill this guy, Kevin? He's a genius. Nuts to your truce.
Come on, dude. I know you ratted them out, and we had to defend our friend, and now it's over. Let's end it.
He seemed very sincere, perhaps due to the colonel's reputation for pranking.
I'll make you a deal. You pick one dead American president. If Pudge doesn't know that guy's last words, truce. If he does, you spend the rest of your life lamenting the day you pissed in my shoes.
That's retarded.
All right, no truce, the colonel shot back.
Fine, Millard Fillmore, Kevin said.
The colonel looked at me hurriedly, his eyes saying, was that guy a president? I just smiled.
When Fillmore was dying, he was super hungry, but his doctor was trying to starve his fever or whatever. Fillmore wouldn't shut up about wanting to eat, though, so finally the doctor gave him a tiny teaspoon of soup, and all sarcastic, Fillmore said, the nourishment is palatable, and then died. No truce.
Kevin rolled his eyes and walked away, and it occurred to me that I could have made up any last words for Millard Fillmore, and Kevin probably would have believed me if I'd used that same tone of voice, the colonel's confidence rubbing off on me.
That was your first badass moment, the colonel laughed.
Now, it's true that I gave you an easy target, but still, well done.
Unfortunately for the Culver Creek Nothings, we weren't playing the deaf and blind school. We were playing some Christian school from downtown Birmingham, a team stocked with huge, gargantuan ape men with thick beards and a strong distaste for turning the other cheek. At the end of the first quarter, 20-4. And that's when the fun started. The colonel led all of the cheers.
Cornbread,
he screamed. Chicken, the crowd responded.
Rice.
Peas. And then all together, we got higher SATs.
Hip hip hooray, the colonel cried.
You'll be working for us someday. The opposing team's cheerleaders tried to answer our cheers with, the roof, the roof, the roof is on fire. Hell is in your future if you give in to desire. But we could always do them one better.
Buy. Sell.
Trade.
Barter. You're much bigger, but we are smarter.
When the visitors shoot a free throw on most every court in the country, the fans make a lot of noise, screaming and stomping their feet. It doesn't work because players learn to tune out white noise. At Culver Creek, we had a much better strategy. At first, everyone yelled and screamed like in a normal game. But then everyone said, shh, and there was absolute silence. Just as our hated opponent stopped dribbling and prepared for his shot, the colonel stood up and screamed something, like,
for the love of God, please shave your back hair.
Or,
I need to be saved. Can you minister to me after your shot?
Toward the end of the third quarter, the Christian school coach called a timeout and complained to the ref about the colonel, pointing at him angrily.
We were down, 56-13.
The colonel stood up.
What? You have a problem with me?
The coach screamed, you're bothering my players.
That's the point, Sherlock,
the colonel screamed back. The ref came over and kicked him out of the gym. I followed him.
I've gotten thrown out of 37 straight games, he said.
Damn.
Yeah, once or twice I've had to go really crazy. I ran onto the court with 11 seconds left once and stole the ball from the other team. It wasn't pretty. But, you know, I have a streak to maintain.
The colonel ran ahead of me, gleeful at his ejection, and I jogged after him, trailing in his wake. I wanted to be one of those people who have streaks to maintain, who scorch the ground with their intensity. But for now, at least I knew such people, and they needed me, just like comets need tails. 108 days before. The next day, Dr. Hyde asked me to stay after class. Standing before him, I realized for the first time how hunched his shoulders were, and he seemed suddenly sad and kind of old.
You like this class, don't you?
He asked.
Yes, sir. You've got a lifetime to mull over the Buddhist understanding of interconnectedness.
He spoke every sentence as if he'd written it down, memorized it, and was now reciting it.
But while you were looking out the window, You missed the chance to explore the equally interesting Buddhist belief in being present for every facet of your daily life, of being truly present. Be present in this class, and then, when it's over, be present out there,
he said, nodding toward the lake and beyond.
Yes, sir.
101 days before. On the first morning of October, I knew something was wrong as soon as I woke up enough to turn off the alarm clock. The bed didn't smell right, and I didn't feel right. It took me a groggy minute before I realized I felt cold. Well, at the very least, the small fan clipped to my bunk seemed suddenly unnecessary. "It's cold!" I shouted.
"Oh, God, what time is it?" I heard above me.
8:04, I said. The colonel, who didn't have an alarm clock, but almost always woke up to take a shower before mine went off, swung his short legs over the side of the bed, jumped down, and dashed to his dresser.
"I suppose I've missed my window of opportunity to shower," he said, as he put on a green Culver Creek basketball t-shirt and a pair of shorts. "Oh, well, there's always tomorrow. And it's not cold. It's probably 80.
Grateful to have slept fully dressed, I just put on shoes, and the colonel and I jogged to the classrooms. I slid into my seat with 20 seconds to spare. Halfway through class, Madame O'Malley turned around to write something in French on the blackboard, and Alaska passed me a note.
"Nice bedhead. Study at McDonald's for lunch?"
Our first significant pre-calc test was only 2 days away, so Alaska grabbed the 6 pre-calc kids she did not consider weekday warriors and piled us into her tiny blue two-door. By happy coincidence, a cute sophomore named Lara ended up sitting on my lap. Lara had been born in Russia or someplace, and she spoke with a slight accent. Since we were only 4 layers of clothes from doing it, I took the opportunity to introduce myself.
"I know who you are," she smiled. "You're Alaska's friend from Florida."
"Yep. Get ready for a lot of dumb questions, 'cause I suck at pre-calc," I said. She started to answer, but then she was thrown back against me as Alaska shot out of the parking lot.
"Kids, meet Blue Citrus, so named because she is a lemon," Alaska said. "Blue Citrus, meet the kids. If you can find them, you might want to fasten your seatbelts. Pudge, you might want to serve as a seatbelt for Lara."
What the car lacked in speed, Alaska made up for by refusing to move her foot from the accelerator. Damn the consequences. Before we even got off campus, Lara was lurching helplessly whenever Alaska took hard turns, so I took Alaska's advice and wrapped my arms around Lara's waist.
"Thanks,"
she said almost inaudibly. After a fast, if reckless, 3 miles to McDonald's, we ordered 7 large French fries to share and then went outside and sat on the lawn. We sat in a circle around the trays of fries, and Alaska taught class, smoking while she ate. Like any good teacher, she tolerated little dissension. She smoked and talked and ate for an hour without stopping, and I scribbled in my notebook as the muddy waters of tangents and cosines began to clarify. But not everyone was so fortunate. As Alaska zipped through something obvious about linear equations, stoner baller Hank Walston said,
Wait, I don't get it."
"That's because you have 8 functioning brain cells."
"Studies show that marijuana is better for your health than those cigarettes," Hank said.
Alaska swallowed a mouthful of French fries, took a drag on her cigarette, and blew smoke at Hank.
"I may die young," she said, "but at least I'll die smart. Now, back to tangents."
100 days before. Not to ask the obvious question, but why Alaska? I asked. I'd just gotten my pre-calc test back, and I was awash with admiration for Alaska, since her tutoring had paved my way to a B+. She and I sat alone in the TV lounge, watching MTV on a drearily cloudy Saturday. Furnished with couches left behind by previous generations of Culver Creek students, the TV room had the musty air of dust and mildew, and perhaps for that reason was almost perennially unoccupied. Alaska took a sip of Mountain Dew and grabbed my hand in hers.
"Always comes up eventually. All right, so
My mom was something of a hippie when I was a kid. You know, wore oversized sweaters, she knitted herself, smoked a lot of pot, etc. And my dad was a real Republican type. And so, when I was born, my mom wanted to name me Harmony Springs Young, and my dad wanted to name me Mary Frances Young. As she talked, she bobbed her head back and forth to the MTV music, even though the song was the kind of manufactured pop ballad she professed to hate. So, instead of naming me Harmony or Mary, they agreed to let me decide. So, when I was little, they called me Mary. I mean, they called me Sweetie or whatever, but like on school forms and stuff, they wrote Mary Young. And then, on my 7th birthday, my present was that I got to pick my name. Cool, huh? So I spent the whole day looking at my dad's globe for a really cool name. And so my first choice was Chad, like the country in Africa, but then my dad said that was a boy's name, so I picked Alaska. I wish my parents had let me pick my name, but they went ahead and picked the only name firstborn male halters have had for a century. But why Alaska? I asked her. She smiled with the right side of her mouth. Well, later I found out what it means. It's from an Aleut word, Alyeska. It means that which the sea breaks against. And I love that. But at the time, I just saw Alaska up there. And it was big, just like I wanted to be. And it was damn far away from Vine Station, Alabama, just like I wanted to be. I laughed. And now you're all grown up and fairly far away from home, I said, smiling. So congratulations. She stopped the head bobbing and let go of my unfortunately sweaty hand. Getting out isn't that easy, she said seriously, her eyes on mine like I knew the way out and wouldn't tell her. And then she seemed to switch conversational horses in midstream. Like after college, know what I want to do? Teach disabled kids. I'm a good teacher, right? Shit, if I can teach you pre-calc, I can teach anybody. Like, maybe kids with autism. She talked softly and thoughtfully, like she was telling me a secret, and I leaned in toward her, suddenly overwhelmed with the feeling that we must kiss, that we ought to kiss right now on the dusty orange couch with its cigarette burns and its decades of collected dust. And I would have. I would have kept leaning toward her until it became necessary to tilt my face so as to miss her ski-slope nose, and I would have felt the shock of her so soft lips. I would have. But then she snapped out of it. No, she said, and I couldn't tell at first whether she was reading my kiss-obsessed mind or responding to herself out loud. She turned away from me, and softly, maybe to herself, said, Jesus, I'm not going to be one of those people who sits around talking about what they're going to do. I'm just going to do it. Imagining the future is a kind of nostalgia. Huh? I asked. You spend your whole life stuck in the labyrinth, thinking about how you'll escape it one day, and how awesome it'll be, and imagining that future keeps you going, but you never do it. You just use the future to escape the present. I guess that made sense. I had imagined that life at the creek would be a bit more exciting than it was. In reality, there'd been more homework than adventure. But if I hadn't imagined it, I would never have gotten to the creek at all. She turned back to the TV, a commercial for a car now, and made a joke about Blue Citrus needing its own car commercial. Mimicking the deep-voiced passion of the commercial voiceovers, she said, It's small, it's slow, and it's shitty, but it runs. Sometimes. Blue Citrus. See your local used car dealer. But I wanted to talk more about her and Vine Station and the future. Sometimes I don't get you, I said. She didn't even glance at me. She just smiled toward the television and said, You never get me. That's the whole point. 99 days before. I spent most of the next day lying in bed, immersed in the miserably uninteresting fictional world of Ethan Frome, while the colonel sat at his desk, unraveling the secrets of differential equations or something. Although we tried to ration our smoke breaks amid the shower's steam, we ran out of cigarettes before dark, necessitating a trip to Alaska's room. She lay on the floor, holding a book over her head.
Let's go smoke, he said.
You're out of cigarettes, aren't you? She asked without looking up.
Well, yes.
Got $5? She asked.
Nope.
Pudge? She asked. Yeah, all right.
I fished a five out of my pocket, and Alaska handed me a pack of 20 Marlboro lights. I knew I'd smoke maybe five of them, but so long as I subsidized the colonel's smoking, he couldn't really attack me for being another rich kid, a weekday warrior who just didn't happen to live in Birmingham. We grabbed Takumi and walked down to the lake, hiding behind a few trees, laughing. The colonel blew smoke rings, and Takumi called them pretentious, while Alaska followed the smoke rings with her fingers, stabbing at them like a kid trying to pop bubbles. And then we heard a branch break. It might have been a deer, but the colonel busted out anyway. A voice directly behind us said, "Don't run, Chipper." And the colonel stopped, turned around, and returned to us sheepishly. The eagle walked toward us slowly, his lips pursed in disgust. He wore a white shirt and a black tie, like always. He gave each of us in turn the look of doom. "Y'all smell like a North Carolina tobacco field in a wildfire," he said. We stood silent. I felt disproportionately terrible, like I had just been caught fleeing the scene of a murder. Would he call my parents? "I'll see you in jury tomorrow at 5, he announced, and then walked away. Alaska crouched down, picked up the cigarette she had thrown away, and started smoking again. The eagle wheeled around, his sixth sense detecting insubordination to authority figures. Alaska dropped the cigarette and stepped on it. The eagle shook his head, and even though he must have been crazy mad, I swear to God, he smiled. "He loves me," Alaska told me as we walked back to the dorm circle. "He loves y'all, too. He just loves the school more, that's the thing. He thinks busting us is good for the school and good for us. It's the eternal struggle, Pudge, the good versus the naughty." "You're awfully philosophical for a girl that just got busted," I told her. "Sometimes you lose a battle, but mischief always wins the war." 98 days before. One of the unique things about Culver Creek was the jury. Every semester, the faculty elected 12 students, 3 from each class, to serve on the jury. The jury meted out punishment for non-expellable offenses, for everything from staying out past curfew to smoking. Usually it was smoking, or being in a girl's room after 7. So you went to the jury, you made your case, and they punished you. The eagle served as the judge, and he had the right to overturn the jury's verdict, just like in the real American court system, but he almost never did. I made my way to classroom 4 right after my last class, 40 minutes early, just to be safe. I sat in the hall with my back against the wall and read my American history textbook, kind of remedial reading for me, to be honest, until Alaska showed up and sat down next to me. She was chewing on her bottom lip, and I asked whether she was nervous. "Well, yeah. Listen, just sit tight and don't talk," she told me. "You don't need to be nervous. But this is the 7th time I've been caught smoking. I just don't want... whatever. I just don't want to upset my dad." "Does your mom smoke or something?" I asked. "Not anymore," Alaska said. "It's fine. You'll be fine." I didn't start to worry until it got to be 4:50, and the colonel and Takumi were still unaccounted for. The members of the jury filed in one by one, walking past us without any eye contact, which made me feel worse. I counted all 12 by 4:56, plus the eagle. At 4:58, the colonel and Takumi rounded the corner toward the classrooms. I never saw anything like it. Takumi wore a starched white shirt with a red tie and a black paisley print. The colonel wore his wrinkled pink button-down and flamingo tie. They walked in step, heads up and shoulders back, like some kind of action movie heroes. I heard Alaska sigh. "The colonel's doing his Napoleon walk."
"It's all good," the colonel told me. "Just don't say anything."
We walked in, 2 of us wearing ties and 2 of us wearing ratty t-shirts, and the eagle banged an honest-to-God gavel against the podium in front of him. The jury sat in a line behind a rectangular table. At the front of the room by the blackboard were 4 chairs. We sat down, and the colonel explained exactly what happened.
"Alaska and I were smoking down by the lake. We usually go off campus, but we forgot. We're sorry, it won't happen again."
I didn't know what was going on, but I knew my job. Sit tight and shut up. One of the kids looked at Takumi and asked,
"What about you and Halter?"
"We were keeping them company," Takumi said calmly.
The kid turned to the eagle then and asked, "Did you see anyone smoking?" I only saw Alaska, but Chip ran away, which struck me as cowardly, as does Miles and Takumi's aw shucks routine, the eagle said, giving me the look of doom. I didn't want to look guilty, but I couldn't hold his stare, so I just looked down at my hands. The colonel gritted his teeth like it pained him to lie.
It is the truth, sir.
The eagle asked if any of us wanted to say anything, and then asked if there were any more questions, and then sent us outside. What the hell was that? I asked Takumi when we got outside.
Just sit tight, Pudge.
Why have Alaska confess when she'd already been in trouble so many times? Why the colonel, who literally couldn't afford to get in serious trouble? Why not me? I'd never been busted for anything. I had the least to lose. After a couple minutes, the eagle came out and motioned for us to come back inside. Alaska and Chip, a member of the jury said, you get 10 work hours doing dishes in the cafeteria, and you're both officially one problem away from a phone call home. Takumi and Miles, there's nothing in the rules about watching someone smoke, but the jury will remember your story if you break the rules again. Fair?
Fair,
Alaska said quickly, obviously relieved. On my way out, the eagle spun me around. Don't abuse your privileges at this school, young man, or you will regret it. I nodded. 89 days before.
We found you a girlfriend, Alaska said to me.
Still, no one had explained to me what happened the week before with the jury. It didn't seem to have affected Alaska, though, who was, one, in our room after dark with the door closed, and two, smoking a cigarette as she sat on the mostly foam couch. She had stuffed a towel into the bottom of our door and insisted it was safe, but I worried about the cigarette and the girlfriend.
All I have to do now, she said, is convince you to like her and convince her to like you.
Monumental tasks, the colonel pointed out.
He lay on the top bunk reading for his English class, Moby Dick. How can you read and talk at the same time? I asked.
Well, I usually can't, but neither the book nor the conversation is particularly intellectually challenging.
I like that book, Alaska said.
Yes. The colonel smiled and leaned over to look at her from his top bunk. You would. Big white whale is a metaphor for everything. You live for pretentious metaphors.
Alaska was unfazed.
So, Pudge, what's your feeling on the former Soviet bloc?
I'm in favor of it? She flicked the ashes of her cigarette into my pencil holder. I almost protested, but why bother?
You know that girl in our pre-calc class, Alaska said. Soft voice, says this, not this. Know that girl?
Yeah, Lara. She sat on my lap on the way to McDonald's.
Right, I know, and she liked you.
You thought she was quietly discussing pre-calc when she was clearly talking about having hot sex with you, which is why you need me.
She has great breasts, the colonel said, without looking up from the whale.
Do not objectify women's bodies, Alaska shouted.
Now he looked up.
Sorry. Perky breasts.
That's not any better.
Sure it is, he said. Great is a judgment on a woman's body. Perky is merely an observation. They are perky. I mean, Christ.
You're hopeless, she said. So, she thinks you're cute, Pudge.
Nice.
Doesn't mean anything. Problem with you is that if you talk to her, you'll, your way to disaster.
Don't be so hard on him, the colonel interrupted, as if he was my mom. God, I understand whale anatomy. Can we move on now, Herman?
So, Jake is going to be in Birmingham this weekend, and we're going on a triple date. Well, triple and a half, since Takumi will be there too. Very low pressure. You won't be able to screw up because I'll be there the whole time.
Okay.
Who's my date? The colonel asked.
Your girlfriend is your date.
All right, he said, and then deadpanned. But we don't get along very well.
So, Friday? Do you have plans for Friday?
And then I laughed, because the colonel and I didn't have plans for this Friday or for any other Friday for the rest of our lives.
I didn't think so. She smiled. Now, we gotta go do dishes in the cafeteria, Chipper. God, the sacrifices I make.
87 days before.
Our triple and a half date started off well enough. I was in Alaska's room, for the sake of getting me a girlfriend she'd agreed to iron a green button-down shirt for me, when Jake showed up.
With blonde hair to his shoulders, dark stubble on his cheeks, and the kind of faux ruggedness that gets you a career as a catalog model, Jake was every bit as good-looking as you'd expect Alaska's boyfriend to be. She jumped onto him and wrapped her legs around him. God forbid anyone ever does that to me, I thought. I'll fall over. I'd heard Alaska talk about kissing, but I'd never seen her kiss until then. As he held her by her waist, she leaned forward, her pouty lips parted, her head just slightly tilted, and enveloped his mouth with such passion that I felt I should look away but couldn't. A good while later, she untangled herself from Jake and introduced me.
"This is Pudge," she said.
Jake and I shook hands.
"I've heard a lot about you."
He spoke with a slight southern accent, one of the few I'd heard outside of McDonald's.
"I hope your date works out tonight, because I wouldn't want you stealing Alaska out from under me."
"God, you're so adorable," Alaska said before I could answer, kissing him again.
"I'm sorry," she laughed. "I just can't seem to stop kissing my boyfriend."
I put on my freshly starched green shirt, and the three of us gathered up the Colonel, Sarah, Lara, and Takumi, and then walked to the gym to watch the Culver Creek Nothings take on Harsden Academy, a private day school in Mountain Brook, Birmingham's richest suburb. The Colonel's hatred for Harsden burned with the fire of a thousand suns.
"The only thing I hate more than rich people," he told me as we walked to the gym, "is stupid people. And all the kids at Harsden are rich, and they're all too stupid to get into the creek."
Since we were supposed to be on a date and all, I thought I'd sit next to Lara at the game. But as I tried to walk past a seated Alaska on my way to Lara, Alaska shot me a look and patted the empty spot next to her on the bleachers.
"I'm not allowed to sit next to my date?" I asked. "Pudge, one of us has been a girl her whole life. The other of us has never gotten to second base. If I were you, I'd sit down, look cute, and be your pleasantly aloof self."
"Okay, whatever you say." Jake said, "That's pretty much my strategy for pleasing Alaska."
"Aw," she said, "so sweet. Pudge, did I tell you that Jake is recording an album with his band? They're fantastic. They're like Radiohead meets the Flaming Lips. Did I tell you that I came up with their name, Hickman Territory?"
And then, realizing she was being silly,
"Did I tell you that Jake is hung like a horse and a beautiful, sensual lover?"
"Baby Jesus," Jake smiled, "not in front of the kids."
I wanted to hate Jake, of course, but as I watched them together, smiling and fumbling all over each other, I didn't hate him. I wanted to be him, sure, but I tried to remember I was ostensibly on a date with someone else. Harsden Academy's star player was a 6'7" Goliath named Travis Eastman that everyone, even his mother, I suspect, called the Beast. The first time the Beast got to the free throw line, the Colonel could not keep himself from swearing while he taunted,
"You owe everything to your daddy, you stupid redneck bastard."
The Beast turned around and glared, and the Colonel almost got kicked out after the first free throw, but he smiled at the ref and said, "Sorry."
"I want to stay around for a good part of this one," he said to me.
At the start of the second half, with the Creek down by a surprisingly slim margin of 24 points and the Beast at the foul line, the Colonel looked at Takumi and said,
"It's time."
Takumi and the Colonel stood up as the crowd went, "Shh."
"I don't know if this is the best time to tell you this," the Colonel shouted at the Beast, "but Takumi here hooked up with your girlfriend just before the game."
That made everyone laugh, except the Beast, who turned from the free throw line and walked calmly with the ball toward us.
"I think we run now," Takumi said.
"I haven't gotten kicked out," the Colonel answered.
"Later," Takumi said. I don't know whether it was the general anxiety of being on a date, albeit one with my would-be date sitting 5 people away from me, or the specific anxiety of having the Beast stare in my direction, but for some reason, I took off running after Takumi. I thought we were in the clear as we began to round the corner of the bleachers, but then I saw, out of the corner of my eye, a cylindrical orange object getting bigger and bigger, like a fast-approaching sun. I thought, I think that is going to hit me. I thought, I should duck. But in the time between when something gets thought and when it gets done, the ball hit me square across the side of the face. I fell, the back of my head slamming against the gym floor. I then stood up immediately, as if unhurt, and left the gym. Pride had gotten me off the floor of the gym, but as soon as I was outside, I sat down. "I am concussed," I announced, entirely sure of my self-diagnosis.
"You're fine," Takumi said as he jogged back toward me. "Let's get out of here before we're killed."
"I'm sorry," I said, "but I can't get up. I have suffered a mild concussion."
Lara ran out and sat down next to me.